Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Thoughts. Do you think any of our outlaws were hot daddies?
What a segue.
Absolutely. Ned Kelly is older sibling, raised the siblings. Because Red was in jail most of their childhood, wasn't he?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he was in another jail, and then he got he was an alcoholic, and then he got sick, and then he died.
Yeah, so Red wasn't really around. Ned was the man of the house for a long time.
Ned and Red?
Yeah. Ned Kelly's father was Red Kelly.
Yep. And what was the kid, Ted Kelly?
Probably.
They had Ned, and then it was...
Oh, his younger brother, who, like, went and became an outlaw with him, was Dan.
Dan Kelly, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. He could have been a daddy, but it just didn't really work out for him.
The universe
didn't work out. That's upsetting.
Do you have to be a dad to be a daddy?
What about Dick Turpin?
No, okay.
Dick Turpin didn't have daddy energy.
No, he did not have daddy energy.
Still more of the larrikin, the himbo energy.
I don't even know if that's what I would call it. I feel
actually,
like Dick Turpin...
I don't think Robin Hood was... Now that I think about it, I don't think Robin Hood was a himbo.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's too violent.
That's true. Himbos have to be kind.
Yeah, Dick Turpin was not... No, he was kind of a dick, frankly.
Yeah, larrikin at best. Robin Hood was not a good guy, by all accounts. Like one of the earliest accounts of, like, fictional accounts, obviously, of Robin Hood, Little John beats him in an archery contest, and so Robin assaults him.
Is this the episode? Are we in the episode yet?
I mean, yeah. Let's just fucking start it. Okay. How do we feel about that?
Cool. No, I think what we should do, I think we should keep this all in, don't edit out the bit about daddies at the beginning, but still label the episode Thieves, and
yeah.
They can just, like, figure out when we start.
Yeah, they can decide for themselves.
So, welcome to Dungeon Deep Dive. It's another week here in the studio, and by here in the studio, I mean in three different bedrooms. Coming to you not live from the studio is my regular co-host...
It's me, Grace Shadell, and I'm here.
She is here.
She is here.
Spiritually, we'll have to find out.
Exactly.
Emotionally? How about emotionally?
I haven't been emotionally present since about 2014.
That's the correct answer.
As you know, my name's Tully Grimley, and with us is our first ever... No, actually, that's a lie. Our second ever guest on Dungeon Deep Dive. Tell us about yourself.
Oh, yeah, so I am a Virgo.
Name is Brooke Riley, by the way.
Color painting. No, I was building up to that bit. Hello, everyone. My name is Brooke. I'm filling in for Lachlan today because Lachlan has unfortunately died. What happened? Where's Lachlan?
Lachlan is currently being murdered by a number of assignments.
I actually have them tied up in my basement because I wanted to be on the episode. I wanted to be on this dumb podcast for a really long time, and Telly wouldn't let me. So I was like, I guess I'll have to take Lachlan out of the equation. And here we are. It's worked.
It has been since the first episode that you've wanted
absolutely,
to be on this podcast,
actually. Yes. Why has it taken so long? I am full of
Brooke
chaotic,
was, I think,
sexy,
our first
useful
subscriber.
Energy. I absolutely was. I think you talk about it in one of the first episodes. I was re-listening to them the other day, and you mentioned me by name, and I was like, oh my god, I've made it.
I'm pretty sure from the very first episode, me and Brooke were like, oh, whenever you do guests, like, hands up, like, we're interested, and the only reason why I am the new host and not Brooke is just because of, like, nepotism.
Yeah, I just managed
to get in first and know someone just, like, you know?
I had to Google nepotism.
Yeah. So this week, we are looking at thieves, and it's a little bit of a different episode. We're actually going to take three different case studies from throughout myth and history and talk about them pretty freeform. It's a bit loosey-goosey this week. We are recording on the traditional lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people of Meanjin, otherwise known as Brisbane. These lands are stolen land, and sovereignty was never ceded, but we would like to pay our respects to the traditional owners and custodians of the land, and to elders past, present, and emerging. And if you do want to have a part in this conversation, if you do want to speak on those issues, please get in contact, and we'll have you on the show. Get in contact on all our socials at Dungeon Deep Dive, or email us at deepdivetnc@gmail.com. Yeah. Sorry, back to Grace.
Okay, so now that we know Ned Kelly's name and his brother's name and his father's name.
That's it. That's all we need to know.
Well, I mean, basically. So Ned Kelly was the third child in a family of 8 kids. So yeah, big sibling energy. Mm. His father was an ex-convict who was sent to Australia for pig theft.
Interesting.
That's
actually
two...
a pretty high profile, like, theft as far as like first settlers go.
Those things are heavy.
Yeah, he stole 2 pigs in Ireland, and then they were like, to the colonies with you, sir.
I just imagine him carrying...
Like, there were people who got served for stealing tea and bread.
I just imagine him carrying 1 pig under each arm and then getting caught and just dropping the pigs.
Yeah. He was like, but then, oh, I don't know whose pigs those are. They're just with me. But basically, okay, so this was really weird the way they worded this, but he was a convict, he was released, he bought land. Basically, both his parents were ex-convicts, and they were given land by the government under an agreement that they'd pay half up front and pay rent for the next 7 years while they proved that they could use the land to develop the agriculture of the area, because they were still trying to, like, set up proper towns and stuff.
That's right. I forgot about this. It ran really similarly to, like, the feudal system, where the government owned the land and it would essentially have you pay rent to work the land.
Yeah. So eventually, once you paid half up front, and after 7 years of paying rent and proving that you would be a responsible land owner, because, I mean, you were all ex-convicts, you had to, like, prove yourself, that land was then yours. If the government thought that you were responsible enough and you'd proved yourself. The sort of land rights were a bit shaky and led to a lot of issues, but basically... Ned
I mean, land
that...
rights in Australia have famously been, I mean, shaky at best.
Yeah.
Shaky is probably the best word you could ever use to describe Australian land rights.
Okay, so these land rights, I'll get to the land rights in a second. Basically, a lot of issues started happening after... Ned Kelly's dad was sent back to prison for 6 months, and this is interesting wording, but he was sent back for having meat that he couldn't account for.
Same. Absolute same, my dude. I'm just absolutely packing, and I just don't know why.
I mean, this is pretty much a hallmark of the Kelly family's relationship with police from... this point onwards, pretty much, is they are essentially constantly being told that they can't do things that they have a right to because, I don't know, this looks a bit suspect, so fuck you.
Yeah, basically they were like, you have a lot of meat and you're very poor and meat is expensive. Where did you get this? Why do you have it? And he was like, I don't know, dude, this is my meat. I've bought it. I don't have, like, a receipt for you. And they said, oh, well, you must have stolen it, and they shipped him off to jail. And he came back... an alcoholic and died shortly afterwards, which left his mother and her, I think at the time there were 5 children, because he had 8 siblings, but I think a couple, some of them died quite young.
Hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of deaths in the Kelly family.
Yes.
There were a lot of kids, I mean, like, statistically speaking.
Yeah, it was pretty rough at the time.
I mean, children, you do just treat children like statistics until they reach about 16, right? That's how families work.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, maths will decide if these ones survive, you know?
Yeah, basically. But not only were they sort of, felt like they were at the mercy of the police, which they very much were, because they, like, being ex-convicts, they were constantly under scrutiny and they had to prove themselves in order to keep this land. So not only did they have to pay for it, they had to, like, uphold the reputation and create this new, like, image of themselves in order to be allowed to keep it. But there was also something called the squatocracy.
The what now?
Which was essentially, it's like a play on words. It's like the squatters' aristocracy, where basically middle class to upper class farmers of the area would just like, because technically they said the crown owned the land and it wasn't developed or anything, these big farmers would just like let their cattle and their like livestock graze wherever, and sometimes that meant that they grazed their livestock on other people's land and they were technically squatting on it, but because they were like they had more of a standing in the community, nobody would say anything. They were like, oh, you're rich, nobody's using this land anyway, so like you get to use it, but somebody owned that and wanted to use it.
Right. Oh dear. Okay, I can see where this, knowing a little bit about the Ned Kelly story myself, I can see where this is going to play in. Yeah, and it's not good.
As a teenager, he'd been arrested a couple of times for associating with other bush rangers. He was accused of stealing a horse. He joined a gang called the Greta Mob, who apparently were referred to as Bush Larrikins. Like, they weren't outlaws or anything. They were just, like, a fun gang of kids that would, like, be a little rowdy and sometimes steal cattle and stock and stuff, but, like, nobody could pin it on them. The problem with Ned Kelly was his family was constantly being accused of stealing cattle, because they were trying to start a farm on their land, and somebody else was also sometimes using their land to graze cattle and other livestock.
Mm.
So if one or two cows ends up in the wrong field, or somebody says, that's mine, and they say, that's mine, then it was sort of like, you know, first in, best dressed, with opinions on whose livestock was whose.
Yeah, and basically, because the police never trusted the Kellys, in any dispute, Kellys were fucked. Even if they'd bought these cows, they were still fighting uphill to try and keep anything that they'd purchased.
Yeah.
And it's worth saying that there's no doubt that Ned Kelly stole cattle and brought it home, but also that anything legally acquired or otherwise was always going to the complainant.
Yeah, so he was confronted about his involvement with cattle stealing at his family home, and it turned violent, and he was charged with attempting to murder a police officer. Because, like, the cops showed up, and they were like, hey, you stole cattle, come with us. And he said, I didn't steal any at all. I won't go with you. And they said, I mean, they got into, like, a fight. And the cops are like, you tried to kill me. That's attempted murder. And then his mum was arrested for helping him. And he was like, well, now you've gone and done it. You've got my mum, and I will get my revenge on you. But yeah, basically, so shortly after his mum was arrested and he was charged with attempted murder, him, his brother, and like two of their mates went and confronted the cops, and they shot three of them. And obviously the cops are like, well, okay, you guys are outlaws now. Which makes sense, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so for 2 years after that, he dodged the police, mostly due to the fact that he had, like, super wide network of supporters and sympathizers, because a lot of that, like, that area was all very poor, majority of them were ex-convicts, and they were like, yeah, the police keep harassing us too, and we're glad that you're fighting back. So he got a lot of help. Him and his little gang robbed a bank in Euroa, and they raided a town called Gilderie. just before they robbed the bank, he wrote a 58-page manifesto just, like, talking about why he did what he did and essentially professing his innocence.
Oof.
Which is called... They have, like, a name for it. It's called the Gildery Letter.
Yeah.
The Gildery Letter.
Yeah. So, basically, in this...
Yeah. The opening line is great. I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the present, past, and future.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he's like, okay, listen up. I've got stuff to say. So basically, he admits to his crimes, but he says that he didn't murder the policeman who came to his house. He's like, and this is a quote from it. He says, "This cannot be called willful murder, for I was compelled to shoot them or lie down and let them shoot me." So he was like, they had it out for me from the start, and if I didn't stand up for myself, they were going to kill me.
It was self-defense.
Constable Fitzpatrick that is the police officer in question. Constable Fitzpatrick, who becomes a lifelong enemy of Ned Kelly and the Kelly gang.
It's very cinematic. So the letter wasn't actually printed until the 1930s in full.
Oh, wow.
They printed excerpts and stuff in newspapers and things, but basically they were concerned that it would make him seem more sympathetic to the public, and they were concerned that it would turn the poor, which was the majority of the country, against the authorities. They were like, we don't want to risk this because people already don't like us.
Yeah, I mean, manifestos historically have a really good reputation.
Yeah, so in this letter, he describes the cops as a parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed pig, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splore-footed sons of Irish bailiffs or English landlords.
That was... pop off!
He was like, you guys are ugly and privileged and I hate you. You're mean.
I just want to really break down this insult. Ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big belly, magpie-legged. Okay, so what we've got is a wombat head with a fat neck, very large belly, but then magpie legs. So I don't know how the magpie legs are going to hold this up. Yeah, but then narrow hips as well. So it's definitely like very top-heavy.
I'm thinking of like an Eggman sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, like... shape-wise, that's what we're looking at, just with all of the bulk happening at the top and then very skinny magpie legs. And tiny hips as well.
So what I want to know here, is this a sort of chimera that we can create for our games?
I think so. That's what I was thinking.
So let's work. What are the elements again? There was a wombat-necked.
So wombat head. The wombat is the head.
A parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked.
So fat-neck.
Wombat-headed.
Wombat head.
So big belly, ugly.
Big belly, animal big not belly. Specified, just big belly.
Big belly, magpie legged.
Magpie legs.
Magpie legged.
Narrow hipped.
So that's where the join between the big belly and the narrow hips is going to be an interesting one to sort of figure out anatomically.
Mm-hmm. Splore footed sons of Irish bailiffs or English landlords.
Okay, so we have to factor in the English landlord / Irish bailiff heritage, right? Like, that's got to come into play somewhere.
Yeah.
Slew-footed.
Yeah.
Means...
Splore. S-P-L-A-W.
Splore-footed.
Oh, splore-footed. Okay, so they face outwards.
Yes. It's powerful imagery. Apparently, like, people who read over this letter, and there's copies of it online, I just didn't have time to read it in full. He writes pretty well. Apparently, he didn't write it. He read it out and got his mate to write it down because he wasn't literate. And by all accounts, it's not very... It's got no grammar. It's not very, like, well-educated, but the spelling's fine, and it's very evocative to read. Everyone was like, wow. Wow, this guy knows what he's talking about.
Poetry.
Beautiful. So, after that, it kind of did all go downhill for him. In 1880, he attempted to derail and ambush a police train. And,
that's a really compelling story, that one.
Yeah, he failed. He didn't do it. him and his gang were dressed in armor made from stolen metal and then had a famously drawn out gunfight with the cops where Kelly was the only survivor and was horribly injured when captured. Obviously, they found him guilty of a lot of crimes and he was sentenced to hanging. And despite the thousands of supporters he had attending rallies and petitioning for his reprieve, he was hanged at Old Melbourne... What is it? Old Melbourne Goal. If you want to use the correct terminology.
Yeah.
And so this is the his final words, I'm assuming you're about to get to, yeah?
Yeah, such is life. They're not 100% sure. That's what they're reported as being. That's what everyone goes with. You can see it on bumper stickers and tattoos all over this wide and beautiful country.
Yeah. As far as the Glen Rowan affair goes, so this is the Glen Rowan affair is basically parceled from the murder of Aaron Sherritt all the way through to The Last Stand, where they took the Glen. I think it's the Glen Rowan Hotel.
Yeah. That's where they, like, fell back.
Yeah. And then the police... I can't remember if it's the police or the Kelly gang, but someone set fire to the forest surrounding. And so there's this forest fire going. This bushfire going while there's this massive shootout. I think Dan Hart got killed. Kelly is reported to have passed out 5 or 6 times throughout this gunfight. So... you can only imagine how wild everything was if they didn't notice that Ned Kelly passed out multiple times. Yeah, and this sheet metal armor that they were wearing, which was so heavy that Kelly could barely move.
Mm. Yeah, like, they didn't have great, like, they couldn't really do anything. You couldn't run in that thing. You could only really just, like, not get shot for a little bit.
This, I think, is the most iconic armor of all time.
Yeah.
I would go as far as to say, like, there is no set of armor that is more iconic, specifically, than Ned Kelly's armor.
Mm. I mean, also, like, as much as they talk about the shootout and stuff as being, like, brutal and horrible, they did make very clear their plans for if they were successful with this train. And it was they wanted to wreck the train and shoot dead any survivors, then ride to the unpoliced town. Because this was a police train, so they wanted to wipe out all the cops.
Then
ride to that town that the cops were supposed to be in, where they said they were going to rob banks, set fire to the courthouse, and blow up the police barracks.
That's a lot.
They then wanted to release anyone imprisoned in the jail, and this is in quotes here, generally play havoc with the entire town before returning to the bush. So they were going to walk in, destroy this town, set free all the prisoners, and say, ACAB.
Yep.
Yeah, and so this is where there's this view of Ned Kelly as being this really well-spoken, well-thought-out person who is for the people and generally a very kind and forgiving person.
He was for the people. He was well-spoken. But he was not kind or forgiving.
No, it doesn't seem.
And that's the thing is, like, there's it's one thing to be anti-establishment or to be anti-police, and you can understand an anti-police sentiment definitely from the Kelly perspective. Like, there's no interaction that he had with law enforcement that ever went well.
It was positive.
But to deliberately go to kill an entire police train worth of people, shoot dead any survivors, and then go to the barracks, kill any other policemen there, and burn down the barracks. It's hard to reconcile that with that positive, like, that almost idol that we've got for Ned Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, the thing is, though, it was really only the cops that he had an issue with. Because, like, before the shootout, before anything happened there, while I was still waiting for this train to show up, they had 62 hostages at the hotel that we were just talking about.
Whoa.
And he had 62 hostages, and while they were waiting for the train to show up, because they had the hostages so no one could raise the alarm, because they didn't want anyone to let the cops on the train know what was coming. Mm-hmm. And, basically, for hours while they waited for this train to show up. The gang insisted that drinks were to be provided to the townspeople and that music was to be played, and they just, like, hung out and got drunk and danced with these hostages.
Yeah, they had a party.
And, yeah, they just, like, hung out and had a good time. Apparently one of the hostages was like, yeah, it was great. He didn't treat us badly at all. And actually, he captured a constable that was in town and later let him go, believing that he was a sympathizer. He was like, yeah, this is a guy who's doing this job because he has to survive, and we think that he is sympathetic to our goals, so we'll let you go home to your wife.
And that was their undoing, actually, wasn't it? Because yeah, he was the one that raised the alarm that meant the train, they stopped the train before the tracks that got destroyed.
Yeah, so the hostage that he let go did then go tell the cops what was happening, and the train didn't show up.
Yeah, because they went out with a lantern and stopped the train before the derailed section, and as a result, the cops then got to ambush the Kellys. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, once they realised that the train wasn't coming, that their plan had failed and the cops were coming for them, apparently they sent all the townspeople home. They stayed in the pub and they let all the townspeople return home because they were like, look, we are going to stay here and fight, and you can stay with us if you want, but, like, you guys can go home.
Yeah.
This isn't... Yeah. He sent them home and told the hostages to lie low. And oh, what did he say? Go quietly to bed and not dream too loud.
Yee.
It's all in all incredibly well spoken.
Yeah. So they had a good plan. They had hostages. They had plans to stop the cops finding out what happened. And it was only because he said, this one cop is cool. Go home to your wife, and so you can look after her. And that cop immediately was like, I'm going to go to the cops.
Man.
That's rough.
That's real rough that the one cop they ever trusted fucked them.
Knocked.
Yeah. Yeah. He was reported afterwards as being the last expression of the lawless frontier and what was becoming a highly organized and educated society, the last protest of the mighty bush now tethered to iron rails to Melbourne and the world.
Yeah.
That was deep.
Yeah, he's very much the last bush ranger that we know of. That, like,
he's the only one that I know of.
As a public image, he's the last bush ranger.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, after that, Australia really did become developed and start to, like, move slowly away from its convict roots. They were trying to make themselves respectable.
They were rebranding.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is my last point. I just thought it was a fun little tidbit. Apparently, when he was 11, he saved a kid from drowning. And nearly died himself, and they awarded him with a green sash. It was just like a very nicely sewn green shiny sash, and he wore it under his armor in the final fight, and it's in the Benalla Museum. Wow. Apparently still stained with his blood.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rife with symbolism, this story. For anyone outside of Australia, I think most of our listeners are Australian, but we do have I think it was an Icelandic listener or a Swedish listener.
Yeah,
hell
we've
yeah.
We've got a couple of listeners. We've got a listener or two in the UK. So to all of you outside of Australia, highly recommend you check this out. There's a bunch of really good movies. There's one with Heath Ledger, I think, which is, I mean, it's a movie. It's a big budget movie, but it's also, as far as the main points, relatively faithful to the actual story. Great retellings, if not. Shout out to a guy called Benedict Braxton Smith. He wrote a musical called Metalhead. I'm not sure if you'll ever get a chance to see it, but if it does make it onto Broadway, you have to. It's great. But yeah, the story of Ned Kelly is rife with symbolism and stunning characters. I'd like to, since we're breaking from format a little bit and doing three case studies, I'd love to talk a bit about what this means for an RPG standpoint.
Yeah.
So I really love this as a backstory because it's never outright tragic, but it is a story of constant belittlement and constant targeting from law enforcement. And so as a reason to be against authority, this is, I think, probably the most compelling I've ever seen, which is just this, it's this symbolic everyman who is beaten down constantly and who sometimes, yes, did it, but at no point was awarded a fair trial, at no point was awarded his chance to speak his mind. And it manifests itself in this, okay, fuck it, that's it. We're going full on outlaw now.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really fun and really interesting when you consider that from the eyes of the law, that was just a no good family that got themselves into trouble time and time again and wouldn't learn their lesson before going off the rails completely. So, like, you look at this from either side of the story and it's still really compelling because it's either this like hard done by guy just trying to get by who's constantly attacked, or it's like, oh my god, not this kid again. Didn't I teach you a lesson last week, old man?
That's the thing. If the police are already saying go fuck yourself, why not just fuck that? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, from their perspective, it's like, I mean, they already think we did it. Guess we're gonna do it now.
May as well do it. Yeah. And as far as the way that they treated others, there is this really compelling narrative of always being for the people. I mean, they were known to burn debt notices. When they robbed banks, they would demand the notices of mortgages and debts and burn them so that the banks couldn't prove that anyone owed them money.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
this really was... I mean, it wasn't exactly a Robin Hood story, although I'll get to that later. but very much there was this concern for the common man like, hey, can I have those debt notices? Woof, they're up in flames. Guess you can't prove it.
No, that's a bummer. That's a real shame. I wish someone would do that now. Less murder. Please, though.
I mean...
With less murder, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, his manifesto letter that he wrote, which he tried to get published into pamphlets to have printed.
Wow, he, like, just hand about on the street.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically he showed up in, in the town that he was going to rob, and he, while they were robbing down the street, went looking for the printmaker, and he handed it to the printmaker, and he said something. Basically, he, like, threatened the guy down the printers. He was like, this better get, here we go, mind you, it get printed, or you'll have me to reckon with next time we meet.
Jesus
Christ. He was like, he was so dedicated to having his word get out there, and the only reason that wasn't printed was because the printmaker got on a horse and rode down to the train station to get to Melbourne so he could, like, give it to a lawyer.
Oh boy.
Jesus.
And they didn't print it. They refused to print it because they said that it was, like, it was too controversial.
I'm just noticing just even little bits of this story, which really do... It's such a snapshot of Australian life. Like, here we are. So the £8,000 reward money was divided amongst various claimants. £6,000 went to the Victoria Police. Superintendent Hare received £800 of that.
Wow.
Seven Aboriginal trackers involved in the siege were each awarded £50, but their money was given to the Victorian and Queensland governments for safekeeping. The reward board's argument being, it would not be desirable to place any considerable sum of money in the hands of persons unable to use it.
Oh my god. Now that, oh my god!
That basically entirely sums up the interactions of any Australian government with Indigenous owners of the land. Hey, we're gonna pay you a token sum for your help, but also we're not gonna give you that money because you can't use it properly, so we'll keep it for safekeeping. We'll look after it.
Jesus,
that's basically
Christ.
The land rights arguments all over is, yep. Oh yeah, it's your land, kind of. No, it's ours. We'll use it.
But, yeah,
like, you weren't using it anyway.
Yeah. There's also a good snapshot in one of his letters where he talks about the sort of police corruption. He wrote here, if a poor man happened to leave his horse or bit of calf outside his paddock, they would be impounded. I have known over 60 head of horses impounded in one day. And then he names the cops that did it. And he says, all belonging to poor farmers that would have to leave their ploughing or harvest to other employment to go... and he names one of the like richer farmers in the area. And perhaps not have money enough to release them. So basically he was like, you're targeting poor farmers who have no other source of income. And this is like destroying their lives and their business. And they'll never be able to prove themselves responsible landowners and be able to stop paying rent on this land because you keep like destroying their business.
Their livelihoods, yeah. Hmm.
And again, if you want to pit the town police or the town guard as the bad guys, this is the perfect way to do it because they can, in theory, protect their actions as being lawful, but every witness can say that they are being unfair.
Yeah.
It'd be good. It'd be like a good game to run.
Yeah. I've for a long time wanted to run. I need to talk to some people about land rights and representation because I don't have that knowledge myself, but I've really for a long time wanted to run a game using the Savage World system in colonial Australia because I just think that's such a compelling narrative, that whole area, because you've got so many different groups in play, even from the nationalities of convicts before they were brought into Australia. I mean, there's a really interesting part in this story where there's a dispute between Ned Kelly and a Chinese pig farmer called Ah Fook. Now, Chinese farmers were not held in very high regard at all, but they were just one rung above Kelly in the social standing, and so they believed a Chinese pig farmer, a pig and bird dealer from Morses Creek, because he was seen to be more reputable than an Irish convict. And this is a time, I think it's 1869. This is in the midst of the gold rush. Asian migrants were seen as vultures because they were known to... there were many cases where people would go mining and panning for gold. They wouldn't find anything. And then Chinese migrants would come on and they would re-pan the area and they'd find all the little bits that people had missed. And so they were seen as vultures swooping in for to take people's hard-earned money. So sentiments were not great. I mean, let's face it, sentiments to immigrants in Australia always been bad, despite the fact that everyone with an anti-immigrant stance is an immigrant to some degree. But it was so bad back then. And yet, the Kellys were seen as lower in that social caste system than a Chinese farmer.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I just think that little... like, those little details that you find throughout are such a snapshot of life at that time.
I've got Ned Kelly's Wikipedia page up because I love to research. But I was just reading about all the things that happened to his body after he died. They said his body was dissected by medical students who removed his head and organs for study, but then like dissection out of a colonial inquiry was illegal. So there was all this public outrage about like they dissected this body that wasn't part of a colonial inquiry. And then the students were like, no, the commissioner of police or the jail's governor was like, no dissection took place. But then like they had a look at the body again in 2011 and a dissection had taken place. And then his grave was robbed and then his skull was stolen on a separate occasion to the grave being robbed. And then like the skull was like, apparently the skull was like back and forth. They didn't know where the skull was for a very long time because it was stolen and then found again. But it wasn't until 2010 that they confirmed that the one that was found was the same skull.
They used one of his ancestors to supply DNA to check the like remains. His 62-year-old grandniece.
Wow.
Which I'm
pretty sure the only surviving members of his family were the three younger daughters.
Gosh.
So it would have been one of their children.
Mm.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Man, imagine being one of those girls. You're like just like a 20-something-year-old woman in colonial Australia, and your family reputation is trashed, and you're like, I guess I'm not getting myself a rich husband like I wanted.
Think about their lives, though, because, I mean, their family reputation is completely trashed because they are associated with the Kelly gang, but they have no breadwinners in the house. None of the former breadwinners of the house because... Red obviously died quite early on in the story. Mm-hmm. Ellen Kelly, who is an absolute boss, by the way, just stunning woman. Ellen Kelly, again, was mistreated and died. And Dan Kelly obviously was associated with the gang, so also was not there. Other siblings died early on. So you've got these three younger siblings who have no money, no land, no home, I'd suppose. They're pretty much in colonial Australia trying to make their way on their own.
Mm.
So I'd actually be really interested in looking at the stories of their lives and seeing what we could dig up from that, but that's a whole other research project.
Yeah. I imagine it's a lot harder to track the lives of, like... two poor, socially outcast women in colonial Australia.
Oh, I'd imagine that's rather difficult.
Yeah. There's an ongoing issue with tracing, like, working class women throughout history, because they weren't allowed to own property, they weren't allowed to, like, go to school or anything, so there's no paper trail.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, diaries of upper class and middle class, like, upper middle class women, who, like, kept them for school and for housekeeping purposes. But anyone who actually had to, like, do all the housework themselves, there's really no account for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how literate they were taught to be before they no longer had access to education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wild. Ned Kelly was illiterate. He got somebody else to write his letter for him.
Yeah, he dictated it, didn't he? Yeah. It's absolute icon of a man, and definitely worth looking up the story if you don't already know it, because there's so many interesting elements to it.
Grace, the final question, is he a daddy?
He is daddy.
Yeah.
I actually think he is daddy.
Yeah, slightly unhinged, but real paternal energy, real daddy energy, but also, like, definitely a hottie.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the photos of him.
Yeah, there's the really famous photo, which is that sepia side portrait. Like,
oh, there's the mugshot of him aged 15, and God, he's a man at that point.
Is that the one with the...
He's still got quite a young jawline, but he's a man.
Yeah. He has some aggressive eyebrows. They're very straight.
He does have... But that cowlick, look at his
hair. Yeah, see, that's the photo I'm talking about.
The mugshot on the day of his execution. If you just look up Ned Kelly, the Wikipedia page has it as the photo of him. But it has this perfectly combed sides, this swept up waves of hair on the top. He's got this huge bushy beard. And, yeah, he's just... this intense stare.
This is absolutely what Tully Grabelli wishes that his hair would do.
Oh, absolutely. This is the look that I want to go for. Beautiful. Well, let's jump from Ned Kelly over to Dick Turpin.
Oh, are we? Okay. First thing I'd like to say is I did Dick Turpin, but then I also did a bunch of research on interesting female thieves because I was like, I want that diversity. So... I don't know if you want me to do both together, but I have a whole thing about Dick Turpin, but then also a bunch of small things, about a bunch of cool ladies.
Yeah, do the whole lot, and then I'll finish up with Robin Hood.
I might do the ladies first, because we were just talking about the mother being kind of a boss bitch.
Yeah, so, Ellen Kelly, absolute boss bitch.
Absolute boss bitch.
And I will have no argument against it.
So I've also, okay, yeah, I'll talk about my beautiful ladies first. I just wanted to know about cool female lady thieves. Turns out there was plenty of them. Probably not as many as there were dude thieves, but you know, that's just the patriarchy, am I right?
It's at this point where Grace's microphone shuts off, so she's going to be conspicuously absent for the next hour, but we've tried to edit around it. Enjoy.
There's no boundaries to the glass ceiling.
No, oh my god, just let me do crime in peace, thank you very much. So these are just like, I just have like a little pieces of information about them all, because I think they're so interesting. Probably one of the most famous female thieves is Bonnie Parker of Bonnie and Clyde.
Of course.
Half of that duo is a dude, so I don't really care. I mean, I care about the Bonnie part, the Clyde part can get fucked. When I was doing research, one of the most famous highwaymen I found, because originally I was looking at highwaymen specifically, I found a highwaywoman called Catherine Ferris. And Catherine Ferris is really interesting. She was active in middle of the 17th century, so 1634 she was born, she died in 1660. She also got a reputation as the Wicked Lady. So that was the name that she sort of became known as. She was married off at a pretty... She was born into luxury, which is really interesting. Like, she was born to a pretty wealthy family. She was born into nobility because someone... But then she became the sole heir to her grandfather's fortune. She was married off to her younger stepbrother, which was... Sorry, Catherine. She was, like, rich and, like, married to a husband who, firstly, she was related to and also was out fighting in the war a lot. And so she just kind of got bored and decided to start doing crime, which is really cool.
That's amazing.
So this description is from a website. So
this is a rogue with the noble background.
Basically, yeah, this is the description of her, and I really love it. Something of an evil Bruce Wayne. She is said to have had a secret room tucked away behind a staircase in her manor, and it is here that she prepared for her raids. Donning the traditional highwayman's garb, a tricorn hat, a black mask, and a cloak, she took off each night through a secret exit on the back of a jet black horse. The other thing that's interesting about her is, like, she was loaded. She didn't do this for the money. She did it for the shits. Like, she did it for shits and giggles. She just enjoyed terrorizing travelers, and that was it. She got a bit of violence sometimes. She would occasionally attack and brutally murder her victims. But, like, if you're not in it for the money, why not go hard or go home? She is also thought to have slain cattle, shot a policeman, and burned down houses with their occupants still inside. So just kind of a little bit of a loose unit is what I'm getting at here. And then she died when she was 26. I don't believe her exact scene of her death is known, but I think it sounds like she was wounded and killed during a holdup. That's Catherine Ferris. I read a little bit about someone called Alice Diamond, who was part of this thing called the 40 Elephants Gang. So this was in the UK. There was this gang called, I think it was the 40 Thieves Gang or the 40 Knights Gang or some shit. Alice Diamond started a gang or was part of a gang called the 40 Elephants, which was a gang of female crime bitches, basically. Just like this gang of like ladies who would like party and like do the regular flapper things, but then also would do crime. They were known by police as the cleverest gang of hoisters in London, because mostly what they would do is shoplift. And they were just like had an incredibly tight bond. There was like this group of just like cool ladies who would just like dance and then shoplift, and they would just like fuck everyone else. I thought that was cool. I just like the idea of this cool badass female gang doing crime.
I love this. So the imagery of this too. So at the time where she was active was between the two major world wars. That was the big time where she like was the height of her crime career. When the height of the average man was 5'6", she came in at 5'8". She wore diamond rings on the fingers of both hands and could deliver a punch a man would have envied.
I let her punch me. This. That's all I'm going to say.
I love the idea of this, like, 6'2", this 6'2" lady dressed in a flapper dress with diamond rings on both hands who will just knock you flat on your ass.
That's all I want in life, please.
Oh, man.
So that's Alice Diamond and the 40 Elephants Gang. Next up, I did some research about Frederica Mandelbaum, who was called by the press at the time as the nucleus and center of the whole organization of crime in New York City. So basically, Frederica Mandelbaum, who became known as Mom, ran a massive, what a queen, frankly, ran a massive crime syndicate in New York, would never do any of the dirty work herself, but would organize like a legion of, like, she had pickpocketers, she had con men, she had people who would account, like, would crack safes, and she had absolute mother energy, that's for sure. She actually financed a crime school called Mom's Grand Street School, where she would teach kids to come in and teach them how to pick locks and open safes. One of her students was a guy called Adam Worth, who became a very famous thief around the time. Mom was, of course, arrested at some point, but also so loved by the community that she was let out on bail, and she fled the country with $1 million. And then she, like, lived in Hamilton in Canada and died at, like, 86.
This is $1 million in, what, 1920-something?
So Frederica was active in 1862 and 1884 she was active.
Mm.
So, like, Jesus, that million would have been worth... That's a lot of fucking money, yeah. So, just, like, huge mother energy from her. I really enjoy that. I did a bit of research about Stephanie St. Clair, who was known known as Queenie, but to the Harlem residents, known as Madame St. Clair. So Stephanie was born in the French West Indies. I believe one of her parents was French and the other one was African. And then they migrated to the United States in 1911. A bunch of kind of whack stuff happened to her that maybe is a bit too much to go into right now, but shit got fucked for her. And then... Jeez. In 1917, so 6 years after she moved to the US, she invested $10,000 of her own money in a clandestine lottery game in Harlem and then slowly began to work her way into the numbers game in New York, and by the end was basically running the numbers game in New York in the 1920s. So she was involved in policy banking, investing, gambling, and playing the lottery. One of the biggest reasons that she was doing this is that banks at the time wouldn't accept black customers, so they couldn't invest their money legally in any way. And so policy banking wasn't technically legal, but it was the only way for, like, black individuals in Harlem to invest their money at all. So at the same time as she was just, like, absolutely destroying the numbers game in New York, she did a lot of, like, political work in terms of addressing race issues in Harlem and, like, things like police discrimination and brutality. She is known to have been one of the only women involved in the numbers game at the time, and did a lot to help the black community by providing them with jobs as numbers runners, and just, like, other jobs that she had in the business. And obviously she made bank, because that's the point of doing money things.
And also being the boss of the money things.
Oh, absolutely. Owning the money things. And was known to put out ads in local newspapers to educate the community about their own legal rights and voting rights. And she would often call out police in newspapers for brutality against the black community.
Oh.
Yeah, so she got called out. She would complain to local authorities about harassment. And then they would ignore her. And then instead she would put advertisements about police in the Harlem newspapers accusing senior police officers of corruption. And so, of course, they arrested her for it. But what happened when they arrested her? She spent 8 months in a workhouse. In response, she testified to the Seabury Commissions about the kickbacks she had paid police officers and those who... So she basically narked on a bunch of police officers after they arrested her. Which is like, I'm okay with you being a narc in that one. Like,
the please narc, sweetheart. The ultimate counter-narc.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
The ultimate counter-narc.
And she got more than a dozen police officers fired.
Oh man, if that's not a compelling story.
I really like this. I really like this chick. She also, so at the end of Prohibition, Jewish and Italian American crime families started to see a decrease in profits and instead moved into the Harlem gambling scene. So essentially the mafia moved into the gambling scene that she was in, and the mafia would do those mafia things where they would beat up and kill number operators, but then pay, like, it'd be like, if you don't pay us protection, then we'll murder you. And Stephanie was one of the only people in the numbers game who just never submitted to the mafia, like, just would never give in to them. They faced massive violence and intimidation. But what St. Clair did, what Stephanie did, was attack the storefronts of businesses that the mafia ran, tipped police off about him, So the police raided, because the main guy who was running the mafia at this time, it was a Bronx-based mob boss called Dutch Schultz. The police raided his house after she tipped them off, and he got a dozen employees arrested and $12 million seized, which is the equivalent of $172 million in 2019.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Shit got even more fucked after this, because she retired from the numbers game because she was balling, obviously, and married a guy called Sufi Abdul Hamid, who was known as the Black Hitler because he was incredibly anti-Semitic. And then a bunch of shit happened. He, by himself, is wackadoo, and I was going to talk about it, but I was like, well, I've already been talking long enough. But then they broke up because he was cheating on her, and then she just, like, retired, but, like, continued to, like, write columns in her local newspaper about discrimination and police brutality and illegal search raids and just, like, other issues that the Black community faced. Anyway, I mean, I would die for her.
Imagine being the person to cheat on, like, well, to cheat on anyone, but also specifically to cheat on the queen of the Harlem numbers game.
Yeah, who didn't submit to the fucking mafia, like...
Oh, fuck me.
It's going to destroy you. Yes, fuck me. That's exactly what I'm asking for.
Yes.
Here. Please, Stephanie. And then, I don't really know much about this. So anyway, Stephanie St. Clair, incredible, just crime queen. And then I read a little bit about someone called Ma Barker, who was the mother of four children who ran a crime wing. She didn't do anything, but her kids did, essentially, and she was known as the most vicious, dangerous, and resourceful criminal brain of the last decade. And if that doesn't sound like the crime equivalent of Kris Jenner to you, then I don't know who does.
Not only that, that is a quote from J. Edgar Hoover, the president of the United
president.
States.
Yeah. There's a lot of controversy.
This is the woman that inspired the Boney M song, Ma Baker.
Yeah. there's a bit of controversy about how much she actually participated in. Like, there are some people who testified that she didn't do anything, but a lot of people who are like, yeah, she, they're like, they're her kids, and her kids did a lot of fucked up shit, and she absolutely ran it.
I mean, she traveled with her kids when they went on criminal sprees. So if nothing else, she was the matriarch of a crime family.
Which in itself, very cool.
Most, and at most was actively involved and planning.
Yes.
She was killed in a shootout too.
FBI
shootout.
Yeah. Very big Kris Jenner vibes, if you ask me. It's absolutely something Kris Jenner would do if it was
the absolutely. If you ever want an earworm though, Boney M, Ma Baker, of disco. Height of disco.
Anyway, so there's a bunch of just really cool female thieves. You know what? Women can steal too. I forgot to do my joke that I was going to do. I was going to do a joke when we opened up, and I was going to be like, let's talk about the first thief, me, because I'm going to steal your hearts on this episode, everyone. Anyway, now that I've talked about some hot women, let's talk about the one hot man that exists. The listeners at home, you all heard of Dick Turpin. If you've ever watched the television show Horrible Histories, then you should have. I didn't know who Dick Turpin was up until I saw the Horrible Histories video. But Dick Turpin is an English highwayman who was, I'd say he's pretty big in the UK. So to the 1.7 people that listen to this from the UK, you probably learned about him in school or whatever. But he's, I would say, gained some notoriety ever since Horrible Histories made a music video about him starring Matthew Bainton, realistically, is the one hot man that exists. He just played Dick Turpin, and as such, now Dick Turpin is legally that hot. There's this whole thing about Dick Turpin being, like, romanticized, because someone wrote a book about him and spewed all these, like, just, like, said all this stuff that wasn't true, sort of, like, you know, jingled some, I don't know what the sentence I'm trying to say here is, but made him sound fancier than he was. And as such, he really got romanticized in like film and TV and stuff. But then what Horrible Histories did was they made a video being like, you shouldn't have romanticized me. I was a real dickhead. But they made us the most just like sexy video ever. If you haven't seen, just like Google, go to YouTube and Google Horrible Histories, Dick Turpin. Might I also recommend watching, there is a very good video, Drunk Histories did an episode with Joe Lycett about Dick Turpin, and it's funny. Oh. I just recommend it. But if you don't want to do that, I'm going to talk about it. Fun fact, the Dick Turpin article on Wikipedia is one of 5,000 featured articles on Wikipedia, so you know this is good content. Dick Turpin was born... Oh, he was a Virgo. How interesting. He was born in 1705 and died in 1739, but no one cares about that. Dick Turpin was a butcher in his early life. His father was a butcher, so he followed up in the butchery trade. But then, obviously, shit gets a little bit whack. So he was working as a butcher in Essex at the time. Is that correct? Is that the place? It was work with the Essex gang, so I'm assuming he was living in Essex. But there was all this stuff happening at the time with this Essex gang, also known as the Gregory Gang, who were deer thieves. They were big into deer poaching. But around the time that Dick Turpin was doing his butchering thing, his legal butchering thing, that is, just killing like animals legally, deer poaching was becoming a lot more heavily regulated, and like they were upping the fines against it. So in like the late 1970s and the early 1730s, there started to be all these regulations put in place, including one called the Black Act, which forbade hunters and people from disguising themselves or like painting their face black so that they could hunt at night. Essentially, they outlawed blackface so that you couldn't hunt because they didn't want people hunting deers and stuff. When they first brought the Black Act into place, there was they also put out a reward for people who helped catch and identify deer thieves and just like general game thieves, and then a pardon for thieves who turned in their colleagues. So in 1972, I believe, or 1971, there was a £10 reward for anyone who turned a thief in, but because it didn't really fix things, they made it a £50 reward 2 years later. So you would earn £50 if you turned in a deer thief, but that is the equivalent of £8,000 as of 2020, or $15,000 Australian. So you get $15,000 Australian for turning in a deer poacher, basically.
God, the 15k narc tax.
Yes, so there was 15k deer narc tax, and so the Essex gang who were doing this, who were deer poaching, were like, we got to get rid of these deers that we've poached. How about we sell them to a butcher? Dick Turpin, you're a butcher. So that's how, allegedly, Dick Turpin first got in with the Essex gang, was through their deer poaching. And so he just sort of started to vibe with these homies. He stopped butchering, but at the same time, the Essex gang stopped deer poaching. And they all moved into just sort of general robbery. They would just break into houses and rob people, you know, just like, you know, your stock standard B&E kind of thing. Most of their home robbery heists would net them around £300. And that was all well and good until when in 1735, they tried to rob a dude called Joseph Lawrence. And this was a bit fucked, obviously. So they broke into this dude's house and he was like there and he was awake and they wanted to take money from him, but Joseph Lawrence was like, no, I don't want to give you any money. So they dacked him, they pulled his pants down to his ankles, and they dragged him around his house just like that, with just dacked with his pants around his ankles.
Okay, so it was funny when you said they dacked him and then they dragged him around the house.
Yeah,
by
it,
his
gets
ankles.
Less, it gets
it was
less,
a lot
funny.
Less funny.
It gets less funny. So Lawrence still refused to reveal the whereabouts of his money. Dick Turpin beat Lawrence's bare buttocks with his pistols. So they spanked him with his pistols, bruised him, and other members of the gang hit him on his head. Hit him on his head with pistols. They emptied a kettle of water over his head, forced him to sit arse naked on the fire, and pulled him around by the nose and hair. One of the other dudes in the Essex gang, someone, Gregory, took one of the maid servants upstairs and raped her. So it was all got a little bit fucked by this point, obviously. And after so, all of that, they escaped with less than £30 worth of stuff.
Realistically, once you have that much control over somebody, surely you just tie them up and rob the place. Like,
yeah.
This was unnecessary acts of cruelty.
Yeah, so I think part of it was that he had his money stashed somewhere and he wouldn't reveal where it was. But also, there's a lot of things that happened that didn't need to happen because they were... I mean, he was bad. Yeah, it was a pretty bad one, that's for sure. And slowly after this, the Essex gang started to break apart. They worked in, like, small groups. Like these four people would work together and then these two would go over here and work with these people. Like, they'd work in different groups. But they weren't particularly active from 1735 onwards. I did read this one sentence which I really liked, which was, They weren't active in the same way, but the remaining members of the Essex gang were not reported again until the 30th of March, when three of them, and then in brackets, unsuccessfully, tried to steal a horse from a servant of the Earl of Suffolk. And I am just curious about the imagery of successfully stealing a horse versus unsuccessfully stealing a horse. Because I imagine that someone is riding this horse as they're trying to steal it, and that's probably not what the situation is, but I do really like the visuals of them trying to steal a horse while there's someone on it, and then being unsuccessful. Thoughts on that, everyone? Like, they maybe try and pick the horse up, but then they're like, fuck, there's a dude on it, and they put it down and they run away.
Just the image of three thieves trying to pick up a horse,
yeah,
is very funny. Like, they're big things. Horses are big. Just like
horses
pick it up on your
big
shoulder.
Yeah.
It's very much a Three Stooges kind of thing.
Mm. But anyway, so you could, you know, that's something you could do in your role-playing campaign is steal a horse, but unsuccessfully. you roll a horse and the horse takes a shit on you. That's unfortunate. So following this, in 1735...
It really sounds like the actions of an automatic, like a computer-generated DM. Where it's like a neural network has taught this thing how to run a game. It's
DM.
Like, steal the horse. You pick up the horse and put it in your pocket.
I saw a really good, like, it was on Instagram, but it was a screenshot of a Tumblr post about someone who's like, I had a really good idea for a D&D character that is just a talking horse. Because, like, the mother was, like, half centaur and the father was, like, a minotaur top half horse. And so it's, like, one of the kids is a horse and the other one's just, like, a normal human. And it's just, like, there's this really good description about, like, this party breaking in to a castle and they hear, like, a knock on the door and the people who live in the castle open the door and it's just a horse standing there. And they're like, what do we do? A horse just knocked on the door. But then the horse is, like, a D&D character who takes you out.
God.
Anyway, good horse content. In 1735, Dick Turpin sort of started to officially get into highway robbery. This is where he began to be known as a highwayman. That's the name. So in April, he just sort of started doing crimes on the road. He started working with a guy called Thomas Roden. And they would just, like, hit various points along the highway. They got a bounty put on their heads for £100 in the latter half of 1735. Yeah. In August, they robbed 5 people on a coach. And then they attacked some more. This is just sort of accounts of them. They just sort of did a lot of robbing. They did some more robbing. And then they did some more robbing. 1937, he was involved in a horse robbery. So he did. That was one of the big things he did, was rob horses. And again, I don't know how. He began to work with a guy called Matthew King / Tom King. They don't really know what his name was. He's known, he's been incorrectly identified apparently as Tom King, and then his real name was Matthew King. But he met Tom / Matthew King because he tried to rob him. And this is what Joe Lysant talks about in his drunk history bit, was that he goes to rob this guy, and the guy's like, you can't rob me, I'm a highwayman too. And then they bond, and then they start to rob people together.
One thing I do like here is there's this concept that there's this thing that happens all the way through, is every sort of character that they meet has some sort of nickname. And so we end up at this point of highwayman, Dick Turpin, now known as Turpin the Butcher, along mm-hmm. with Thomas Rowden, the Pewterer.
Yep.
And I really like the idea of, as a GM specifically, assigning your players' characters nicknames from the public, so they don't have a say in the nickname, and the public know them as one thing, whereas they're another name.
Yeah, that was like one of the female ones that I was talking about had, I don't remember what it was, but had like one name that certain parts of the public, so like Stephanie St. Clair, for example, was known by Queenie, but specifically by people in Harlem was Madame St. Clair, and like, they just like, and like things like the mafia do it a lot. Like I read a lot about like female mafia bosses and stuff who had names like the Flamingo, because when she had a few drinks, she would get like rosy pink. Yeah, there was one who was, oh, that's who it was. It was the Kissing Bandit. There was Edna Murray. So there was a criminal called Edna Murray who became known as the Kissing Bandit because she kissed a male robbery victim. But she was known in the underworld to other criminals as the Rabbit because she was really good at breaking out of jail. So that's interesting as well. Like the idea of like the press gives you one name, but like your other crime pals call you something else.
Yeah, I've not yet, and like to be fair, I don't watch too many actual plays, but I've not yet seen in a campaign somebody like the players being given a name by the world, because it's very much like as a DM, you want to give your players agency in the way that they present themselves, but it's one thing to give them agency in the way they present themselves, and another to say, hey, here's how your actions were portrayed.
Yeah.
And it's manifested in this nickname that you got. And Lachlan, if you're listening, and I know that you're not, you are absolutely going to be Union Maker.
yeah. So they were working at the time with Matthew King / Tom King and Stephen Potter. There was an incident where they tried to steal a horse, but a bunch of really wacky shit happened because they stole a horse from a guy called Joseph Major, who reported the theft to Richard Bayes. And now Richard Bayes is a guy who is in part responsible for all of the romanticization that happened because he wrote a biography about Dick Turpin that was just like half fact, half fiction. So Richard Bayes, before he wrote this autobiography, tracked the horse down. The animal was identified, but because the animals had not yet been collected by their owners, they elected to hold a vigil. Remind me what a vigil is. It stays awake. Yep. So they had the town basically hold a vigil so that these horses wouldn't get fucked up. So Matthew King's brother then showed up and was apprehended by the party. John King told the police the whereabouts of Matthew King, who was waiting nearby. So basically, Matthew / Tom King's brother narked on him. And then there was a fight. So I believe what happened in this fight is that Matthew was fighting with the constable. And depending on if Joe Lysett's telling is correct, Matthew was like, can you shoot this guy? And then Dick Turpin was like, bang, and shot Matthew King instead of the constable. So Matthew King / Tom King at this point died, potentially by Dick Turpin's hand, although probably not on purpose. Following this event, Dick Turpin ran away and escaped to a hideaway in Epping Forest, where he was seen by a guy called Thomas Morris, who was a servant of one of the forest keepers, and not wanting to be caught, Turpin shot him. And I believe this was Turpin's first actual proper murder. And so that ends up being the whole thing, because now he's a murderer too.
You mentioned that Richard Bayes was the one that did a lot of the romanticization. Mm. There's actually, I've just found a little excerpt from the original text, which describes the event of Turpin killing King.
Yeah, so there's a lot of conspiracy about what the actual event of this was, the murder was.
The way it's described in this text is that King tried to shoot Bayes. But the gun misfired. It flashed in the pan, and so no ammo left. And hearing the gunshot and seeing that he was going to kill Mr. Bayes, Dick then turned around and just, after Bayes goes, you need to shoot King, he shoots Bayes instead. And the words are, Dick, shoot him or we're taken by God. And then the following line is, Dick, you have killed me.
Me, sorry for the inappropriate joke. Me when quarantine ends. There we go. There it is. Got it out there, lads.
There we are. Done.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Because that was a whole, that ends up being a really big event because because Bayes obviously survived that. Bayes survived. Bayes was shot, but Bayes survived, and then Bayes wrote a biography. But King died in this instance. And then he killed Thomas Morris. He's dead. He did some more highway robbery at this point. There is a sentence here that just says, Turpin may have also lost his mount. So we don't know if the dude's got a horse right now or not. Then they stole some horses. The horses were suspected as belonging to highwaymen and his wife. He had a wife. I don't know where the wife comes into this. Was released without charge. And at this point, that's what happened. This is the important bit. Following the killing of Thomas Morris, the servant that he killed in the forest, the bounty was upped to $200. So £200, sorry. So at this point, he's got a £200 bounty on his head. And so it's at this point that he fucks off. He boarded the ferry inn and takes on the alias of John Palmer. So from 1737 onwards, he starts to be known as John Palmer. Because obviously Dick Turpin is like, there's a 200-pound bounty on that fucker. I want to be someone else for a little bit. He ended up in... He travelled between Yorkshire and Lincolnshire. He posed as a horse trader and would hunt with the local gentlemen. And then there's this whole fucking situation where he shot another dude's cock. Specifically his game cock. On 2nd of October 1738, Turpin shot another man's game cock in the street. While being rebuked by John Robinson, who I think is the dude who owned the cock, he threatened to shoot him as well. And so there was all this sort of cock situation happening with Dick.
You've been waiting all episode to use that sentence, haven't you?
Dick had a real cock situation. And yeah. Also, have you met me?
Yeah, true. I should have seen this coming. The moment you said Dick Turpin, I should have said, nope, not happening on this good Christian podcast.
Okay, I'm sorry. If this is a good Christian podcast, then you shouldn't have let me on at all. It's 9:50 at the moment, so legally I'm allowed to say whatever I want. This is OnlyFans hours.
No, you're not allowed to say anything that you want for another 10 minutes.
Okay, 10 o'clock, then I can make dick cop jokes. So they threatened to bind him over, and I don't know what that means, because now we're talking about binding him with the dicks and the cocks. But I think what happened is that they sent Turpin to jail. And he was actually kind of chill about it. He didn't make any escape. So he got sent to jail for the cock incident, but also for threatening to shoot a man. But he was actually kind of chill about it. Like, despite everything else that happened, he didn't try and escape on this occasion because, and I quote, "It has been suggested that Turpin may have been depressed about failures in his life." So he had sort of a depression jail stint. He was just in just like a house of corrections, like a chill jail, but then they had some suspects that he'd also been stealing sheep and horses, and then they were like, this man is too dangerous for piss baby jail, we're going to take him to a beefier jail. So they took him to a beefier jail, and they realized that he'd stolen horses, and stealing horses was a capital offense, which was punishable by death. So from this point onwards, they were kind of like, they're probably going to murder this guy for stealing those horses. But they weren't 100% sure that he'd stolen the horses, because he was known as John Palmer. So then some wackadoo stuff happened. Turpin/Palmer wrote to his brother-in-law and sent him a letter. And I think the letter was basically just like a, here's the situation, please help me. But the letter came from York. And so it had a York post stamp on it. And so when it arrived at his brother-in-law was like, I don't know anyone in York. I'm not paying for this stamp, because this is the olden days where to receive a letter, you had to pay for the stamp. So he was like, I don't know anyone in York, and just refused the letter. The letter went back to the post office, where it was noticed by a postman called James Smith. And James Smith, funky coincidence, James Smith taught Dick Turpin how to write. And so when he saw this letter, he recognized Dick Turpin's handwriting and went, that's not John Palmer, that's Dick Turpin. Took it to the police and got £200 bounty for Dick Turpin. For catching John Palmer /Dick Turpin. Yeah, so he got $200, £200 for recognizing handwriting, which is the equivalent of £32,000 in 2020, which, if I just do some quick maths, $62,000. £32,000. So yeah, so it was £200 at the time, £32,000 now, $60,000 Australian dollars now.
$60,000. Holy shit.
So Turpin was officially charged with the theft of three horses, a mare worth £3, a foal worth 20 shillings, and a gelding worth £3. He was taken to trial, but obviously this is, you know, the 1700s. You don't get a defence barrister at that point. So the accused never had any right to legal representation, and their interests were cared for by the preceding judge. So a bunch of people testified, including the guy who they stole the horses from and James Smith, who recognised the handwriting. Turpin didn't really offer much in the way of questioning his accusers. He was just kind of like, no, I didn't do it. Which is, you know, you're about to be murdered. I think that's probably what most people would do. Turpin told the court that he had bought the hair, that bought the horses and not stolen them. And kept, talking, like he kept trying to justify that he had changed his name to Palmer because it was his mother's maiden name. But obviously that was bullshit. So on the first jury, he was caught guilty of stealing the mare and the foal. And the second proceeding, they charged him guilty of stealing the gelding as well. He kept complaining that he didn't have enough time to form his defence and that proceedings should be delayed until he could call his witness. And also, he wanted the trial to be held at Essex. Before sentencing him, the judge asked Turpin if he could offer any reason why he should not be sentenced to death. And Turpin said, "It is very hard upon me, my lord, because I was not prepared for my defence." That's it. He was just saying he wasn't prepared. Give me enough time. And then they were like, "Yeah, you did the things, and now we'll murder you." So before his execution, he had a lot of visitors. The jail was apparently, the jailer who was looking after him at the time earned £100 in supplying drinks for him and all of the people that were like coming to visit him in his final days. That was pretty fun. He bought a new frock coat and shoes so that, on his last day, he could look fly. And he also paid for 5 mourners to arrive so that there'd be 5 people there crying for him. Because that was a thing you could do back in the day, was buy mourners when you were hanged. Yep. Wow. He was hung. It was a short drop method. So Turpin, this is a sentence that I don't know where this sentence came from, but it's in quotation marks. So someone said it. Turpin behaved in an undaunted manner as he mounted the ladder, feeling his right leg tremble. He spoke a few words to the topsman, then threw himself off and expired in 5 minutes. So he died. That's what happens when you get hung, is you die.
Oh, God. His body.
Yep. Oh, no, they actually left it there. So he died in 5 minutes, apparently, but the short drop method
was quite five minutes of strangulation.
It's a very long time. Because it's such a slow strangulation, they leave the body there all afternoon just in case it takes for ages. So, like, realistically, he could have been there for hours, very slowly being strangled.
Yeah, so the horrific nature of short drop versus long drop just hit me. Like, long drop, they snap your neck, it's over quickly. Short drop, that's agonizing.
Yep.
Although, if you want to give your players a second chance, sorry, here's back to D&D. If you want to give your players a second chance after being hanged for their crimes, give them 5 minutes of strangulation to get themselves out of the situation.
Yeah, figure out what you can do on that bad boy. His body was buried, and then it was stolen a couple times. They think that maybe it was stolen for medical research, and now they don't really know where the body is. They think they have the body in the right place, but who knows? And anyway, that's Dick Turpin. So there's a lot of false information about him completing a 200-mile journey overnight and having a horse called Black Bess and blah, 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 all this stuff, and also just being a real lady killer. None of that is confirmed. So we know he didn't do the journey. We know he didn't have a horse called Black Bess. He had horses for sure, but we don't know what the fuck they were called. And we do not know how much puss he slayed. But if he looked anything like Matthew Bainton, I would have. You know what I mean? So
that is a sordid tale.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. That's Dick Turpin. Highwayman and rapscallion.
Oh, yeah, that's a word for it, isn't it?
Oh, occupations. Butcher, poacher, burglar, horse thief, and highwayman.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. And possibly father.
Possibly, yeah. It says he might have had a kid, but no one really knows. But the question is he a daddy? Yeah, I don't think that he himself would have been a daddy. Matthew Bainton, absolutely. But Dick Turpin, the real one, meh.
Looking at the portraits given, this is the uncle that has all sorts of wild and wacky stories, and you're not sure which of them are true, but you know some of them are.
Yeah, and that's the scary bit.
This uncle is completely broke, but shows up with a Ferrari. Robin Hood. So, I am going to be pretty light on the details for Robin Hood. There is rumour that Robin Hood is based off a real highway, robber. And in fact, there are a few convicted criminals with the name Robin Hood or Robin Hood. Robin being a diminutive of Robert, which is an incredibly common name. And Hood meaning anyone who makes hoods, wears hoods, or sells hoods. The name Robin Hood is the John Smith of Old England times. Or maybe not the John Smith, the Robert Smith. Yeah, it's very common. And as such, it's very hard to tell if there is actually a real Robin Hood that the legends were based off. But the first clear reference made to the mythical Robin Hood is in the poem Piers Plowman, which was published around about 1370s. And the earliest surviving copies of ballads of Robin Hood
are dated back to the late 15th century, so about 100 years later. We all know Robin Hood as, like, robs from the rich to steal... robs from the rich to give to the poor is really... the common person's hero is this really courageous person and generally very, like, cunning. The earliest versions, Robin Hood is very devoted to the Virgin Mary, so likely Anglo-Catholic, but also is famous for his anti-clericalism, so really didn't like a religious establishment, which is, in the time of the 15th century, I mean, the religious establishment pretty much had a stranglehold over the entire of England. But he was a stunning archer, known to have a special regard for women. Now, this, in all of my research, this was never clarified. So I'm not sure if this means Robin Hood was a ladies' man or Robin Hood respected women. Couldn't tell you. It was also a yeoman, which meant kind of like the common person, not a peasant, but also not a noble. Just kind of like your working man.
Mm-hmm.
And was the early, like, relationships in there were animosity with the Sheriff of Nottingham, and other characters included Little John, Much the Miller's son, and Will Scarlet. There was no Friar Tuck, and there was no Maid Marian for quite a long time. They were added later. So, also things about Robin Hood in the original stories is he was a violent man. He was really violent. There's a recount where Robin Hood and Little John have an archery contest, and Little John wins. And so what does Robin Hood do but immediately assault his friend Little John? Just beats the shit out of him right there. There's also, at one point in one of the stories, Robin Hood gets arrested, and Much the Miller's son comes to rescue him, and in the process, just straight up murders a page boy. A little page boy.
What the fuck? Yeah.
And Christ. That's... They make no bones about it. It's just... Yeah. And he murdered a little page. And there's no reference of him ever... of him giving to the poor. There's the earliest sort of maybe reference to him giving to the poor is in the story A Guest of Robin Hood, where he... He's walking down the road and, you know, he loans some money to a knight who'd befallen some bad circumstances. And then he says something to the effect of, I'll give money to the next person who comes down the road if he's a poor man. The next person who comes down the road is a rich man, so he doesn't give him money. But it's believed to have been like the statement of the general rule of thumb of, oh yeah, I'll be generous if somebody needs money.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole legend is said from here to have spread through folklore and spoken word, as well as these Robin Hood games. It became very hard to research Robin Hood games because most of the time you get video games with Robin Hood in it. So it became, yeah, really tough to actually research what this meant. But what it seems to, from what I've seen, is they were kind of plays that were put on with audience interaction. So it strikes me as sort of an early pantomime. Yeah, and this later became associated with the May Day celebrations. And even more so, this is believed to be where Maid Marian and Friar Tuck joined the story, because there was actually plays with Maid Marian and plays with Robin Hood, and that's where they started to mix. It went from Maid Marian in one and Robin Hood in another to a show with Maid Marian and Robin Hood. Yeah, it's not until The Annals of England by John Stowe, published in 1592, that it's first stated that Robin Hood actually stole from the rich and gave to the poor. So that's a solid 220 years that
wow.
Robin Hood was just a general scoundrel and rapscallion. It's really interesting to I thought this was really interesting from a DM's perspective, where this story of maybe a real criminal, but maybe just folklore, has become told and told and told again, and it evolved from this common man, not even a poor man. In some cases, he was a noble fallen from grace, In others, he was a rich man who'd lost his stuff. In others, he was a peasant. Sometimes he was a yeoman. A couple times, he was a knight. But in all regards, he was a champion for the everyman, maybe. There's some question historically if he was meant to be like a symbol of the peasants' revolt. But a couple of historians have actually rebuked this, saying that he, being a religious man, being a common man, and being devoted in these ways to good values, that he was actually seen as upholding the status quo rather than being against it. So it's wild to think that because of this evolving folklore, he went from being just a story about a criminal to being this folk icon. And I love the idea of treating your players' characters that exact same thing, having them like come across a town and discover they're telling the tale of an earlier adventure of yours, but where your story is sort of sordid and you've done some shitty stuff, like any D&D party would, you know, killed an entire, you know, garrison full of guards or whatever. It becomes this tale of how you swindled the local lordship and gave the money out to the townsfolk. I think it'd be really interesting to give them the Robin Hood treatment and see how they take it.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to do the opposite as well, like introduce your party to this person through folklore, and then you meet them and they're a bit shitty. Could be fun.
Yeah, and I also love this sort of ambiguous nature of, is this person real or fake? Because there is actually a real grave that is devoted to Robin Hood, but almost definitely fake. It's not known if the real Robin Hood... There are a couple of, like, real Robin Hoods that were active in the 15th century, but the first mentions were in... The first known mentions are in the 14th century. Also, Robin Hood being such a common name, his crimes at the beginning being very, very, like, so-so. It's wild to think that this is... or this almost is believed to have been, like, an alias that some criminals took on. Kind of like a Dread Pirate Roberts kind of thing. But less lineage and more... This is like the John Doe for criminals.
It's interesting as well that, like, we won't really know. You know what I mean? Like, there's not really any way now of figuring out. It's just this sort of like, man, this is a dude, but maybe he wasn't a dude.
Yeah, we will never know if...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is it's probably best that we don't know. But it's amazing that this piece of folklore is maybe real and has evolved so much. And it's interesting the story treatment that you can take out of that.
I really like this sentence on history.com at the end of the words. It says, "What we do know is that the notion of a brave rebel who lives on the outskirts of society, fighting injustice and oppression with his band of companions, has universal appeal. Whether he's played by Errol Flynn, Russell Crowe, or even, as on a 1979 episode of The Muppet Show, Kermit the Frog." So what I'm getting from this is the real Robin Hood was inside Kermit the Frog the whole time.
The real Robin Hood was the friends we made along the way.
Yes, and that's Kermit the Frog.
So this is, I just think, a fun case study in folklore and these characters that pop up. Because you can have a hero who robs from the rich and gives to the poor, but it's so much more interesting to have the idea of a character that robs from the rich and gives to the poor with nobody ever having received money from a Robin Hood.
It could also be like, you know, this folklore starts by nature of, like, your party just being lying dipshits. Like, our party has done this. People have been like, what did you do? And we go, actually, we kind of nailed it. And then, like, you accidentally start this folklore of, like, how lit you were, even though a bunch of people died.
Yeah. So that's Robin Hood. I told you guys at the beginning that I was going to be a bit loosey-goosey with this. But,
That felt pretty solid goose to me.
Thank you so much, Brooke, for coming along for your debut on the podcast. I'm sure it's not going to be the last time you appear.
It better not be, because I'll murder you.
Thank you, everybody, for sticking through to us till the end. Again, if you want to get in contact, you can catch us at our socials, at Dungeon Deep Dive on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at deepdivetnc@gmail.com. As you've heard in previous episodes, we will give you a shout-out if you email in, and we would love to hear more from you. And... I think here we have definitive proof that Lachlan's ramblings are not the reason we run overtime. It's all of us. Yeah, this has removed all plausible deniability. It's definitely all of us.
Okay, I am willing to admit that I absolutely ramble, but if you thought for a second that you, Tully Grimley, were not part of the problem, then you were wrong. Oh,
I knew it. I reserved the right to give Lachlan shit for it. Of three people to run a podcast, it's a bad combination because we just talk and don't stop.
Because it's probably a bad idea to ever have me on as well with all three of you. Because Jesus Christ.
Yeah, we're going to have to sub somebody out every time we have a guest on because otherwise...
I'll have to steal one of you and put you in my basement.
And so when you let Lachlan out, they'll be back for another week. In the meantime, thank you so much, everybody. Enjoy your games. And if you use any of the stuff that we talked about, please let us know. We would love to have your input on it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Brooke. You've heard me talk for the last 2 hours. I've been doing this thing called the Brooke and Friends Online Open Mic, and they are very good fun. Tully performed at the last one. Grace drew some incredible, beautiful lesbian cowgirls at the last one, and we're doing another one. It is a public event, so if you just go to Facebook and search for the Brooke and Friends Online Open Mic, the next one is on the 8th of May. It's going to start at 7 p.m. We'll just go live on the Facebook Live event. And the theme is Happy New Year's. No, I will not be taking questions about the theme at this time. If you have any questions, please direct them to Tully Grimley because it's his fault. It's the 8th of May and it's Happy New Year's. But they're exactly what they sound like. They are online open mics. If you have any talent and are interested in performing, please let me know because I'm always looking for performers. But they have been an all-round good time the last couple times we've done them, and I'm very excited to do this again.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you, Grace, once again. It's always a pleasure doing this with you. Thank you, Lachlan, and apologies that you couldn't be here tonight. Hope you get out of the basement soon.
Yeah, we'll
to all
see.
Our listeners, catch you next fortnight.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.